Hari Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Bottom of 53. Shamika Rishi was stunned by the realization that although a Kshatriya has the right to defend himself from unwarranted aggression, even by a Brahmana, and certainly it was within Maharaj Parikrit's power to counteract Sringi's curse. Devotees are so forbearing that they never take revenge, even when cursed, cheated, defamed, neglected, or disturbed. To complicate the matter even further, the Lord never excuses offenders of his devotees, whoever they may be. Quote, if the king were to counter-curse my son, thought the Rishi, then this foolish boy might get relief from his sinful reaction. The saintly Parikrit will certainly not do so, however. The only hope is to appeal to the Lord on the grounds that this offense was committed by an ignorant child. The sage did not at all take the offense of the king seriously. 48-50. In the purport to verse 49, Srila Prabhupada sums up the actual situation. The whole incident is now cleared up. Maharaj Parikrit's garlanding the sage with a dead snake was not at all a very serious offense. But Sringi's cursing the king was a serious offense. The serious offense was committed by a foolish child only. Therefore, he deserved to be pardoned by the Supreme Lord, although it was not possible to get free from the sinful reaction. Maharaj Parikrit also did not mind the curse offered to him by a foolish Brahmana. On the contrary, he took full advantage of the awkward situation, and by the great will of the Lord, Maharaj Parikrit achieved the highest perfection of life through the grace of Srila Sukadeva Goswami. Actually, it was the desire of the Lord and Maharaj Parikrit. Rishi Shamika and his son Sringi were all instant. Okay, actually, it was the desire of the Lord. And Maharaj Parikrit, Rishi, Shamika, and his son Sringi were all instrumental in fulfilling the desire of the Lord. So none of them were put into difficulty because everything was done in relation with the Supreme Person. Okay. Right, so again, we see if it's connected to the Lord, things go well. If we don't connect to the Lord, there's a problem. Right? The other element is that you have this problem with the... the devotee does not get too disturbed, but those who disturb, then they'll have a problem. Right? That's the... Because all living entities are dear to the Lord, but those who are surrendered to the Lord then take advantage of that reciprocation and mercy. So in this way, they become especially dear. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes, because the Lord was arranging. See, because you have all these things. It's Kali Yuga, so that will work. You have these Brahmins who are, demons who are. Wanting to take birth. Have a good facility, so they're taking birth in the Brahmin family, so they're given an opportunity to take up Krishna consciousness, but they don't necessarily do it. Right? Then you have Parikrit Maharaj using the facility for his own spiritual advancement. You have the Bhagavatam being spoken. Right? So all these things are happening. Right? So then the Brahminical community can become degraded as desired. right? You know, the Bhagavatam can be spoken so that we can get that benefit. Right? And then amongst the devotees, at least amongst Shamika and Maharaj Parikit, everything is worked out. Yes.
We see in this example that the boy is cursing, but Maharaj Parikit is not doing the same.
Yes.
But then some other example, I don't remember the names, but then there were two. The one cursed somebody, he says, you will have nobody, means you become ghost. And then the response was, okay, then I will curse you with my power, and you also become ghost. So in this case, then what's, you know, is it, what kind of dealing is this? They're both devotees, but apparently...
Depends on the position like that. We see is that... You'd have to see what's the position of those personalities. That would be the one thing. Because these, they're powerful, great personalities endued with all piety, but it doesn't mean that they don't do this stuff. It's only the devotees generally don't do this stuff. It's only the devotee is not involved in these things. But otherwise, as far as the non-devotee goes, even if they're very pious and advanced, they get involved in these things. Because otherwise, where'd they get the power to curse in the first place?
Yes.
Right. It has to come from something. It has to come from some piety.
Right.
So then you see is the power of those who are these great devotees, these pure devotees, and they don't get involved in those kind of things. It becomes a better position. Isn't it? Okay, so chapter 19. The appearance of Sukadev Goswami. Pratigya. Srimad Bhagavatam 1:19-24:25, 19-30. O trustworthy Brahmanas, I now ask you about my immediate duty. Please, after proper deliberation, tell me of the unalloyed duty of everyone in all circumstances, and specifically of those who are just about to die. At that moment, there appeared the powerful son of Vyasadeva, who traveled over the earth disinterested and satisfied with himself. He did not manifest any symptoms of belonging to any social order or status of life. He was surrounded with women and children, and he dressed as if others had neglected him. Maharaj Parikit, who is also known as Vishnuraka, one who is always protected by Vishnu, bowed his head to receive the chief guest. Sukadev Goswami, at that time, bowed his head to receive the chief guest, Sukadev Goswami. At that time, all the ignorant women and boys ceased following Srila Sukadev. Right, because then they figured out this is not just some madman off the street. Right? Receiving respect from all, Sukadev Goswami took his exalted seat. Sukadev Goswami was then surrounded by saintly sages and demigods, just as the moon is surrounded by stars, planets, and other heavenly bodies. His presence was gorgeous, and he was respected by all. Right, so here we see is we're not dealing on this level with pride, though the activities that go on, people take advantage of when they have pride. Will attribute being in a position of authority or other things like this, the tendency is to connect it that that is the situation of pride. And this is a very major mistake. It's a situation in which those with pride can take advantage of and increase their pride. Does that make sense? Just because someone's in a position of authority doesn't mean that they're proud. And that's why they're doing it, or that they have to become proud. But it's a natural situation that people do use for that purpose. Does that make sense? So why we're mentioning this is just because the modern concept that if someone's taking a leading position, it's due to pride. But the point is why? What's the advantage of a leading position? What's the results of people taking leading positions?
People can follow.
People can follow. People get benefit. Okay? So now... If you want to see that Kali Yuga develops nicely, then what do you want to do? Get rid of leadership. You understand? People want to get rid of leadership, but not authority. not means their own authority. So you get rid of leadership, you get rid of responsibility in that position by taking it. Then we see they go on, you know, it's seemingly, it's supposed to be nice, but where is it nice? Right? So here the point is he's satisfied in himself. So it's only because he's been asked to do this, then he's doing it. Right? Why on a big seat? Because if you don't sit on a big seat, who can see you? Right? The idea is that you gain more if you can see who you're talking, who's talking. Right? So then everybody can see, they can reciprocate, they can understand what's going on. Right? Does that make sense? And so if one person is leading the discussion, then what's the problem? Because we see on the other side is that Parikit Maharaj, he's leading the question. Right? And Sukadeva is leading the answer. You know, or Sutta and Shonaka. One leads one leads the other. Because it takes qualification to do both. That's the point. So, here we see is that now, and the question he's asking is that what does one do at the time of death? Because that's the actual crucial point. That's when you shift from one place to another. So, you have to know what you're doing. It's not just because people don't have a plan. Does anybody have a plan for death?
Hare Krishna.
Yes, that's there. But I'm just saying, does the materialist have a plan? Does anybody sit there and say, yeah, I'll fight him, all this? No. It's just, everybody knows, when death comes, that's it. Is there a plan? Where they're going? What? No idea. Because that takes thought. You just take what immediately comes to you. So this is the special question. Right? And so now it's being asked to a special person who can give the answer. Yes.
It's actually for karmic people very difficult to reach in the Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita because this topic of death is like taboo. Nobody wants to talk.
No, yeah.
And as soon as you touch on it, people just... I've seen people, nice conversation, and then you touch on this point, they just turn and then walk out.
Yeah.
Because they can't handle it. It's too intense.
Yeah. Because the attachment, the illusion that... Because it's only a botheration if you don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
You know? If you know what's happening, things don't disturb you so much. Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. We're basically the only ones that are comfortable with discussing it.
Yeah.
You know, as if it's a normal problem. Like, you know, the sun's out this morning, it's not so cold, and, you know, the time of death, if you, whatever you think of, then that's where you go. And, you know, like that. What's for breakfast today? And, oh, today's a Dwaita Charis. There is no breakfast. Okay. Chapter 19 summarizes questions and answers. Question 26 of Srimad Bhagavatam is asked by King Parikit of the sages gathered on the bank of the Ganges. He placed this question before them just prior to Sukadeva Goswami's arrival on the scene. Question 26. Please, after proper deliberation, tell me of the unalloyed duty of everyone in all circumstances. Right. The above question asked by Maharaj Parikit is the first of two distinct inquiries voiced by him in verse 24 and is made evident in the purport of the verse. And so you have these two. They're connected. Because what are you supposed to do under all circumstances, and then specifically what are you supposed to do at the time of death? Right? Because they're in the purport. In this verse, the king has placed two questions before the learned sages. The first question is, what is the duty of everyone in all circumstances? And the second is, what is the specific duty of one who is to die very shortly? Out of the two, the question relating to the dying man is most important because everyone is a dying man, either very shortly or after 100 years. He suffered a slow death, 100 years. The duration of life is immaterial. But the duty of a dying man is very important. Maharaj Parikit placed these two questions before Sukadeva Goswami also on his arrival. And practically, The whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam, beginning from the second canto up to the last 12th canto, deals with these two questions. Right? So these are the real core questions that are the generate the Bhagavatam. The other is how the conversation is going, why we got into this. And then there'll be details. But this is actually why the Bhagavatam is spoken, to answer these two questions. The conclusion arrived at thereof is that devotional service of the Lord Sri Krishna, as it is confirmed by the Lord himself in the last phases of Bhagavad Gita, is the last word in relation to everyone's permanent duty in life. So to surrender to the Lord exclusively, not with some other purpose, right? That's the actual point. Because otherwise, we surrender and keep all these little attachments with us. But the point is you can't, Krishna says, unto me alone. You have to surrender unto me alone. Otherwise, how does the relationship work? How do you do one thing when you're doing something else at the same time? Right? You ever have to try to interact with someone who's talking on the phone? Right? Or who's on Facebook? You know? You understand? It's just, how do you interact? So, it's not pleasing as far as a relationship goes. So that's all Krishna's saying. We're saying, no, but this and that, and I'm just doing this and that. Yes, but what about the interaction? What about the relationship? Because don't worry, if we do it with Krishna, we do it with everybody else. Right? So that's why the devotees are special. They don't do that with Krishna, they don't do it with anybody else. So that's why devotional service is the only solution to the problem of imperfect relationships. It's the only solution. Because it's the only thing that deals with the actual root cause, which is simply focus. Focus, interaction. What is your intent in dealing? That's all. That's correct. All relationships work. It's not correct. How do relationships work? That's it. It's simple. It's not that's in this area but not in that area. That's why these artificial attempts to only cultivate one aspect may help, but they don't solve the problem. Right? It's just like you can get rid of your cold, but that doesn't solve the problem of life. The problem's not the cold. The problem is we're in the material world where you get colds. That's the point. Does that make sense? So, one can deal with these little things superficially and get rid of the immediate seeming problem. But the underlying problem of our relationship with the Lord is still going to make relationships not work good. In other words, if someone's functioning basically at a neutral point, then that's glorified in the world as great. That is a good relationship. Right? Because that, it's 50-50. That's considered good. But Krishna's talking about 100%, 100%. We're not talking 50-50. Because we look at 100% means it's 100% zero. On the transcendental platform, 1 plus 1 is 1. 1 minus 1 is 1. So 100% / 100%. That's what goes on in the spiritual world. That's what relationships can come to. So here, as good as you can get is 50%. So that's what's being. So that's the last word in relationships, right? To one, everyone's permanent duty in life, because it's about relationships. We're people, so it's about being people, interacting with people. Everything else is paraphernalia for interacting with people. That's all it's for. We take the paraphernalia as more important. Right? When somebody wants to do something, they want to do something for, the family or for friends or for something. So they have this idea, I'll do this thing, that'll get all this nice facility, then I can take care. But in the process of doing it, it compromises their relationships. And then when asked about it, well, what is it? Is it going to be that thing or us? Then the thing, no, but I'm doing that for you. But the point is we just want the interaction. Right? You understand? Yes.
We've seen this. There is a problem in many places that those who organize the program for everybody else, this is the issue. They never take part in the program itself. They either just too distracted, or it's very difficult actually for those who are, you know, organizing.
Yes, it is.
To take program as it is seat for kirtan, they can't do it.
No. But the point is if one is absorbed in all that, one is getting the benefit from all that because you're arranging that everybody else can do it. So in other words, if someone is doing, it's running smoothly, but they're not able to take part in the elements themselves, don't worry about it because they're getting the benefit of having arranged that for all the Vaishnavas.
So it is good as if.
As good as if. But on, having said that, now if you have a manager who everything's going perfectly and they are taking part in the program, now they're in another category on their own. Like that. So we've seen a few of that.
In Melbourne, Korma, the big cook, he would spend a week meditating on producing a feast.
Okay.
300 people, right. 15 preps, every prep was exquisite.
Okay.
He'd work in the kitchen all day, then he'd rush off, take bath, come and leave the kirtan.
Okay.
For the afternoon.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Up and down.
Maharaj Parikshit was already aware of this fact. In other words, was the last word in the duty of life. But he wanted the great sages assembled there to unanimously give their verdict on this his conviction, so that he might be able to go on with his confirmed duty without controversy. Because he knew what to do, but he just wanted it confirmed so that he could do it very nicely. Because working under authority is always good. He has especially mentioned the word shuddha, or perfectly correct. For transcendental realization or self-realization, many processes are recommended by various classes of philosophers. Some of them are first-class methods, and some of them are second- or third-class methods. The first-class method demands that one give up all other methods and surrender under the lotus feet of the Lord, and thus be saved from all sins and their reactions. So, therefore, the process that Prabhupada gives and the Acharyas give, because it's the first class method. Because it's pure. In other words, you're doing what authority says, you're following what authority does, right? Their example and their instruction. Right? If one doesn't do one or the other of those, then there's always a weakness. If you do one, it'll be speculative. If you do the other, it'll be sentimental. If you do them both together, then that's proper Krishna consciousness, yes.
What were the two again, sorry?
Following the example and following the instruction. Right? If you just follow the example, it'll be sentimental. If you just follow the instruction and not the example, it'll be speculative. You know what I'm saying? In other words, if you take Prabhupada's philosophy but not the culture he gives, then you see all there is rife speculation. You know, well, this is that, what about this, we could do that, what about, you know, what if Krishna wore jeans? Shastra Dhanma mentions it, but what if? You know, technically, what if, and that as a philosophy, that's called Jainism. That's what they do. That's their claim to fame. Syadvad, what if? But, you know, the famous but, that's their philosophy. So that's what we're talking about. And then that you can, it's obvious, it's direct, you can see it. And then the other is they follow the culture, but don't know the philosophy. So it's sentimental. So that then you see the Hindus. Right? So, yeah. Does that make sense? But their philosophy is speculative on the other side. So you either have the traditional Hindus or you have the nouveau Hindus. Either way. Yes.
ISKCON is a very large institution, and there's quite a large...
It's there to accommodate the universe.
Yeah, and there's a very large number of authorities, either, you know, on different levels.
Yes.
And even though each authority is meant to present the same same Siddhanta, show the best example. Oftentimes devotees who have problems following one authority, they'll go to another to confirm what they want to hear instead of what they're supposed to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll ask one guru a specific question, they'll go to another guru and ask the same question, and they'll get on the internet and get another answer to the same question.
Yeah, you've been spending too much time north of the Volga.
It's not north of the Volga, it's behind the bamboo curtain as well.
This is the same group.
it's dramatic. The question here.
That's just the neophyte. Kids do it. They go to the mom, they don't get the answer they want, they go to the dad.
Yeah. Dad always gives it.
Yeah, so it works out.
Yeah,
it's standard.
But that's mental speculation that leads to offenses, that leads to, crampling the devotional grip. I mean, there's no end to this.
It's neophyte. It's immature.
But it spreads, and then
because
it becomes a trend.
Because immaturity is popular. So the only way to counter it is by presenting what is proper. But it has to be presented from the position where it's clear how it functions. Because where people get distracted is on their conditioning, which is dealing with the detail. So in other words, when they're going to different people to try to get different answers, something that matches what they want, they're trying to get an answer that matches their conditioning, not the philosophy.
Of course.
Yes, right. So that's why the philosophy has to be presented on the transcendental position. The tendency nowadays is in trying to apply it into their own personal life, into others' lives, and into the preaching field that is so varied. Right? It means originally it started out, it was easy. If they weren't in a suit, then you talk to them. Right? So then it was easy. But as it diversifies into a variety of person, natures on the planet, then they're trying to deal with that, but unfortunately, one can make the mistake that because I'm able to relate to this, I can relate to it, they can relate to it, so this is what you're supposed to be doing for the world. When it's the principle that you're using, that's what's related to the world. And the detail you're using works in that area. Because even if you shift a slight area, it won't work. How you deal with people in the like in America, in the South, won't fly in the North, and vice versa. If you're nice in the North, they'll think, what's wrong here? If you're not nice in the South, they'll think, who's this guy? In the West Coast, they just really don't care. Even there it's different. And then from state to state, it will be different. Within the state, it will be different. So that's the problem is if people can't see that and accommodate that, then you're going to end up with this problem. So that is a neophyte problem, because neophyte philosophy is what's being presented rather than Madhyama or Uttama. That it has to be presented from the Madhyama platform. You have to preach for the Madhyamas. You present it so that Kanisthas can relate to it. But if you base it on, well, we have to please the Kanisthas, you'll always lose. Guaranteed, because the Kanisthas don't know what's good for them. That's the whole point. The Madhyama has an idea. He's fixed in that idea. He's gained that mood. Right? But the neophyte, the weakness is they can be, can just be distracted by whatever's going on. You know what I'm saying? So we have to be able to accommodate this.
I mean, I reflect on your 35 years ago, your Sankirtan leader was the supreme authority. If you could access the temple presently, I'm meeting a great personality, and then if you meet,
Even then, if you were second initiated, you were authority.
Yeah.
Because the principle of authority is there. That's the first thing. In Brahmacharya, the first thing taught is respect of authority. If you don't have respect of authority, you can't function as a Brahmacharya. You can't function as a human being. So that's why I say Varnashram is human, non-Varnashram subhuman, because there's no respect. So you find anything where there's organization, there's respect. Even we take it just on the street, and you have organized crime. What's the one thing they always bring up when you deal with them?
Respect.
Respect. Anywhere you go, if there's a tight community, it's respect. Any community that's there, they expect respect. And the interesting thing is, every community like that on the planet all knows that the crackers from the first world don't have it. And they just put them in another category because they know they don't function like that. So they're outside the circle. You see?
Yeah.
So if you don't have respect, it breaks down. So this modern trend is always attacking the position of respect. It's just a trick of Kali Yuga.
So on the basis of the Varnashram system, we can somehow or other establish mutual respect.
Mutual respect.
If you don't have Varnashram, you have chaos.
Yeah, but at least if not, if you have that, if you have the third verse of Shikshastakam, it can work. The point is everybody is an authority for somebody. But the point is there's a hierarchy, and if you don't accept authority above you, you can't function as authority. If you don't accept, if the reason that you're an authority is because you don't accept anybody else in authority and you want to be independent, you're dysfunctional as an authority.
But it seems nowadays, like in the early days, people, when they were interested in Krishna consciousness, moved to the ashram. So you are into a system. Today, people don't join, they stay home.
That doesn't really matter. The point is the association. Like Chaupati, there's 100 people in the temple, there's about 8,000 to 10,000 not in the temple. But the mood is basically the same. Okay, drop off a few thousand that they're new, so they haven't really become fixed in that. But you could probably take the first 5,000, there's not much difference in the mood between them and the 100 in the temple. Like that. So the community is not a problem. The problem is if you use the community against the temple, or say we don't need temples. These are all the same immature kind of dealings that they say it's this or that. This is all duality. It's all mundane. The whole point is you need temples, you need communities. Communities follow temples. Right? Temple is where the training, all these direction and everything goes on. And everybody then therefore lives their lifestyle, how they situate themselves. So that's not a problem. It's very dynamic. It's very natural. And that way, then, you can accommodate, the whole world. Everybody can be involved in God consciousness. But if we create this party spirit, then that's where the problem comes up. And neophytes must create party spirit.
Yes.
It's just what they do. Because, in other words, if you identify with the body, you have to identify with those who have traits similar to yours. Because then you extend your identity. If brahmacharis will do it less, even though they may not have the proper social understandings, they'll do it less because they're not connected with women, so they don't expand it. But those who are connected with women will always expand it.
It's insecurity.
So to trying to create, So the point is that Krishna is the security. Krishna is the game. Krishna is the thing. And then whatever your situation, fine. You don't have to make a philosophy out of it to, eat what you eat or dress what you dress or live where you live. You don't have to make a philosophy. That's your conditioning. Do it if that pleases you. But ultimately, you have to know it has to be given up. Even the Varnashram system as an identity has to be given up eventually. In other words, better Varnashram is an identity than non-Varnashram. But both of them have to be given up to surrender to Krishna. It has to be, I'm servant of Krishna. That's why it specifically mentions Sukadev Goswami was not manifesting any symptoms of any Varnashram. So eventually that has to be done. So unless that's understood, then how do you function today? How do you create something that is based on the opposites of Sarva Dharmam Parityaja, and then say that will get me there? Krishna says there's only one path. There's not many paths. Oh, we'll have a different way to doing it. There is no different way. There's one path. You're moving towards Krishna or away from Krishna. fun part, you can move towards Krishna with your back to Krishna. You can't walk backwards. You can't do that. You know, or sideways, you know, crabs do it. You know, it works. But what's recommended is facing Krishna. That's quick. Could you imagine it, you know? There it is, there's the rolling fields, you know, with the grass just long enough that it looks nice and not too long, you can't run through it, you know, there's a few flowers pointing, coming up, the sun is just coming up on the horizon, the butterflies and all that, the girl's coming in the one direction, the boy's coming in the other direction, it's going in slow motion, you know, the different things, the music swells, and then you look careful and wait a minute, what's going on here? And, you know, one of them's running sideways to the other, and the other one's running backwards, you know. Good, no?
I heard the sound of music.
No, that's the spinning. You have to, there's a difference there. They're moving forward. That's just the ecstasy. So, you understand? So, the point is then, you know, everybody will go, wait a minute here. Listen, that's not the way to do it. So then, why would we make a philosophy that it's okay? Yes, you can engage your conditioning. You can do these things. You connect them all. Yes. But it's not the position you want to maintain. You do it as a temporary thing. You know, it's like you're doing some work and all that, and you know, underneath the sink something goes wrong. You use a rag, you use anything, but you can't say that's a permanent solution. Right? That's the whole
thing. So if you are sincere and honest with yourself,
yes,
you'll know enough is enough.
Enough is that you'll be able to move on. You'll understand that there is higher, there is a better position. And gradually, no one's saying it has to be quick. Whatever's natural. Someone will move through quickly, someone slowly. Generally what it is one moves quick in one area, slow in another.
Yes.
That's why the association is important, because if you associate with where everybody's moving quickly through Krishna consciousness, then you'll move quickly. But if you use the neophyte where you associate with everyone where they're not moving quickly, then what happens to you? So it's simple. In other words, being a neophyte is not a good position. It's a natural position, but no one should try to present it that it's a strong position. No one should make a philosophy about being like that. It's already part of our philosophy to use it. You don't take it out of context. Just like the Vedic music, it has runs of notes, but it's used here and there like a spice. But when you take the runs of notes and make a musical system based only on that, then you have the modern Hindustani classical music. You hear them all. That's one thing you're supposed to, you know, like we'll do it. You know, and that's it. You don't use it all the time, but they make something just out of that, you know? You know, it's like that. It's crazy. So that's the difficulty. You take one thing, overdo it, and then somehow or another say, no, this is the way to do it. No. That music, it's not original. It's not flavored by the mode of goodness. You can hear the original. It's so different from the other. Like that. It's just so different. Because one's original and one is the modes of nature. So it just has to be understood. It's yes, we engage our conditioning, which is in the modes, but if we're under the modes when we do it, it's a waste of time. But if you're engaging the modes in the Lord's service, because the idea is that you're either with the modes or you're nothing. It's still this Mayavad philosophy. Right? That I deal with it, or it means you either do or don't. It's, there's no in between. I can't engage the modes and not be attached to it. This idea is just foreign to the modern culture. It's not foreign to anywhere that, in other words, any place that had a culture before the Christians showed up, it's not a foreign concept. It's not a foreign concept. But it's been lost for a long time. Hundreds of years. But it's so ingrained. It's still part of the culture. If you're talking about, they understand it. But the modern culture, is their business is just to destroy that. But the first thing is the first thing you have to target is authority. Therefore, go after the gurus, the sannyasis, the brahmins, you know, just authority of Shastra, Prabhupada's position. And what are they talking about? What about the absolute dictatorial control of the woman over the house? Is anybody going after that one? No, it'll never come up.
Because it's natural.
Yeah, what about people sitting in a room, have their feet have never touched the ground, and then they're going to make decisions about people on the ground? And because they made the decision in the room and still no one knows about it, it's got to happen. What about that authority? No responsibility, only authority. What about that? What about that authority? Why don't we go after that one? You understand?
Mm-hmm.
You know. So the whole point is there's things that are going on that nobody worries about. So it's not about authority. The principle of being in charge, everybody wants that. We're here because we want to be the controller and enjoyer. The difficulty is that they don't want to accept higher authority that means I have to surrender and give up my control and enjoyment. And that's the bottom line. So the real point is I want to go back to Godhead as I am. Krishna's got to accept me as I am. It's kind of like, hello? You know? So it's... And the fun part is he does accept you as he is. He's sitting in your heart. We're the one that don't accept ourselves as we are. You know, we're saying, hey, accept me as I am, and so therefore it's a great position. No, it's accept me as I am. I'm a rat bag, so... You know, what to do. Yes?
Thank you.
Okay. Question 27, verse 24 continued, but as expressed in verses 37 to 38. I am therefore begging you to show me the way of perfection for all persons, and especially for one who is about to die. Right? So what it is that everybody should do in all situations, what will create perfection for everybody, and specifically for one about to die. Right? So the general things, what are the duties, what is the perfection that those duties will perform, and what's the position at the time of death. Let me know what a man should hear, chant, remember, and worship, and also what he should not do. Please explain all this to me. So he knows something, otherwise how could he ask this?
Yes.
In the original verse 24, Maharaj Pariksit phrases the first and second part of his question thusly. O trustworthy Brahmins, I now ask you about my immediate duty. Please, after proper deliberation, tell me of the unalloyed duty of everyone in all circumstances, and specifically of those who are just about to die. So there's what you should be doing now, what you should be doing, you know, in general. And then the specific thing is you're preparing for something. Just like, what is the student preparing for?
Exactly.
For exams. That's all. The whole year is spent just for exams. That's the point. If there were no exams, no one would prepare. Does that make sense? Yeah. You know, so everything's about that final point. We can say, no, but why that final point? You know, okay, you want to get into college, what do you require?
Good mark condition.
Good marks. From where?
From previous.
In other words, the conclusion of 12 years of study. You need the results of that exam. And if you want to do postgraduate study, you need your undergraduate exam. You understand? So that's the whole thing. It's all about what's at the end. So that's the point. You know, or the thing is, yes.
My teacher Omar gave a class recently and he was talking about being prepared at the time of death, and then he quoted Yam Yam Bhavisma. And I always wondered when Krishna says, whatever you think at the time of death, this is your next birth that you're going to take, next destination.
But yes.
Is it what you think at the time of death, or is it an accumulation of consciousness throughout your life that takes you to your next birth, and not what you think just as you
No, but the point is what are you going to say? Krishna. Do you know what I'm saying?
I wonder what if you can't say anything. But
the point is you can always think. The point is you know when you're dying. This idea that they just die in their sleep peacefully, don't know what's going on. They know.
So it is a combination of consciousness.
The point is what you do during your life is going to affect what you do there. Because what are you going to do? If things are going wrong, well, what do? You take shelter. So where do you take shelter? Yeah. Well, so in other words, you go through your life. You know, your life passed between my eyes and a few like that. But the point is you're going to stop at everywhere where you felt shelter. So in other words, there's no shelter, it goes past pretty quick. Hey, wait a minute. I want to rerun it.
I remember when Rajalila was passing away in Vrindavan, and she was surrendered, and her guru was there, and he was just talking to her, and everybody was chanting, and then she said, "Guru Maharaj, I've got some very strong material desires. You want to talk about it?" And he was going through a translator. She said, "I don't know, I can't face it, but I have to go through this material desire." I said, "What is it?" He said, "I feel like biting into a fresh tomato." And he said, "Just don't worry about the tomato, just keep chanting." You know, she said, "I have one material desire to eat."
One.
You know, to eat. And he says, "That's not a problem."
Yeah. Here's the... So what you think of the time, that's where you go. So you have to be careful. You don't want to end up as, you know, the world's best tomato farmer, or, you know, this year's, you know, prize tomato or something. Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing, you're preparing for that, so one has to be careful about it. However, because Pariket receives no answer from the sages, who take to discussing among themselves the questions of verse 24, until Sukadeva himself arises. In verses 37 to 38, the king repeats his two questions directly to Sukadeva Goswami. The first question, as he phrases it in verses 37 to 38, remains essentially unchanged. What is the duty of everyone in all circumstances? Yet it is undeniable that he expresses his second question more elaborately the second time around. Though the second essential point remains the same. What is the specific duty of one who is about to die very shortly? Note, though, that he strengthens the second question with a request for additional details about, quote, what a man should hear, chant, remember, and worship, and also what he should not do. So that's the point. What he should not do is because it gets in the way of what you're supposed to do. It takes up time. That's why there's recommendations. So when we say, oh, that's archaic, nobody does that these days. Yes, that's right. That's why we have modern society that's going to hell in a bucket. That's why they're there, so that that doesn't happen. Srila Sukadeva Goswami begins his answer in Canto 2. Right? So the sages are discussing, because they themselves are trying to understand it. So then they'll come up with all these points. Sukadeva Goswami has assimilated it. So then he can just immediately just say, this is it. Srila Sukadeva Goswami begins his answer in Canto 2. His answer fits both questions. The one Pariket asked the sages and the one he asked Sukadeva. He completes the answer at the end of the second chapter of the second canto. Ultimately, however, as Srila Prabhupada confirms in his purport to verse 24, his answer spans the rest of the Srimad Bhagavatam up to the glorious departure of Maharaj Pariket from this world. Right, so, in other words, it's to hear and chant about the Lord, then he gives what it is you should hear and chant for the rest of the Bhagavatam. Yes?
We see that Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken to by Sukadeva Goswami to Maharaj Pariket, and then Maharaj Pariket he left.
Yes.
So he heard everything, but he never had any time to practice. So is this a practice of itself?
Yes, means you can become perfect just by hearing, just like Sukadeva became perfect by speaking.
Yes.
So just itself, if you're absorbed in it, it is doing the work at the time. It is a devotional process. It's just a matter of...
Sorry? He did speak to his mother.
That's coming up next year.
Oh, the Brihad Bhagavatam.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, but hearing itself is a practice.
Yeah.
It means it's just, then he's just doing another practice. The point is that, like, we'll hear for a certain time, we can't hear anymore.
Yeah, right.
You know, sit and chant, just can't chant anymore, you have to go and do something else.
Yes, right.
Like that. So the point is here, that's because there's distraction. But for someone on this platform, there's no distraction, so they could do any one of the nine processes eternally. They're comfortable with it. It's not a difficulty. So it itself is practice. It is application. It's not that you have to hear about it and apply it. The way you're hearing, you're already applying it. Because in that hearing, you're already surrendered, you're already absorbing yourself in serving the Lord by the process of hearing. You know, so somebody said, like the gopis, they're serving the Lord just by how they look. Right? You know, say, because their affection for the Lord in that rasa, their form matches that. So Krishna, just by seeing their form, that interaction on that platform of rasa is already happening. They don't even have to interact or speak or that. Just the form itself is. Then, you know, they're speaking, how they'll speak, how they'll look, how each one is service. Each one is perfect. So the same way as hearing is perfect, chanting is perfect, remembering is perfect, everything is perfect. Each one can give the full results. That's why they give an example of one devotee doing one of them only and becoming perfect. Does that make sense? Let alone if you combine them like Ambarish Maharaj and do them all at once. Does that make sense?
So can we say that for us, because our mind is not steady yet, so changing the processes would be the best solution?
Yes, the variety
that
is,
we can always be engaged.
Yes, means the change of the variety of it either is pleasing to the conditioned nature or is pleasing to the constitutional nature. Right? Because the conditional nature is because it can't deal with anything for very long because everything in the material world gets stale.
Yeah.
So you have to change it to seemingly taste the freshness.
Right?
Right? Mm-hmm. And so then depending on how stale it is how long you have to leave it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So then in the spiritual world, then that variety is created because then it gives so many different ways to serve Krishna and so many different devotees can be involved in the process. Right? So, you know, because if you were doing one thing, and that's all there was, everybody would focus on that, and when that's over, then what do they do? Because it's 24 hours, then everybody's doing a different aspect, and so then it's all there that's going on eternally. Does that make sense? So the variety is natural. But here it's because it gets boring. In the spiritual world, because each thing is enlivening. Right, so if this was enlivening, then another way of thinking about it, then that becomes enlivening. So in other words, that speculative process in the spiritual world is enlivening. Here, it disturbs the mind. Right? Okay. Adhyaya Prakashika. In the 19th chapter, Maharaj Prakrit repents for his act, renounces the kingdom, vows to fast until death, as Sukadev arrives in the assembly of great sages. Maharaj Prakrit laments that he insulted the sage. When the king is informed he'd been cursed for his offense, he makes preparation for his death. Fasting, he sits down at the bank of the Ganges and gives himself up to the lotus feet of the Lord. After hearing of the great king's plight, the many rishis arrive. Maharaj Prakrit welcomes them and tells them of his decision to fast until death. The sages glorify the king's decision, and Maharaj Prakrit responds by inquiring from the sages about the duty of one who is about to die. Immediately after Maharaj Prakrit submits a sincere inquiry before the lotus feet of the august assembly, the exalted sages at once rise to honor the arrival of Sri Sukadev Goswami. Approaching the assembly, accompanied by a crowd of gawking ignoramuses, the young and beautiful Sukadev seemed unconcerned with social conventions, yet he exhibits the auspicious personal symptoms of an extraordinary personality. Indeed, his appearance reminded the learned persons present of Lord Krishna himself. Maharaj Prakrit offers him respect, glorifies him, and then inquires about the duty of one about to die. Shloka of Sharanam, summary of verses. Verses 1 to 19, Maharaj Prakrit renounces his kingdom. Verses 20 to 24, Maharaj Prakrit questions the sages about the duty. Verses 25 to 40, the arrival of Srila Sukadeva Goswami. Verses 1 to 19, Maharaj Prakrit renounces his kingdom. When the king is informed that he's been cursed for his offense, he sits down at the bank of the Ganges and gives himself up to the lotus feet of the Lord. After hearing of the great king's plight, many rishis arrive. The sages glorify the king's decision, and Maharaj Prakrit responds by inquiring from the sages about the duty of one who's about to die. So one may ask, why is it they would glorify? He's given up everything, and the sages are saying this is great. But we see other situations where someone says, oh, he wants to give up everything, and they say, no, you don't have to do that. Arjuna wanted to give up everything, and Krishna said, no. Why? What's the difference? Okay. That's okay, that would be a general thing, but as Prabhupada pointed out, everyone's about to die, whether it's going to be now or after 100 years. Right? So definitely you have that aspect. But there's another thing there. What did Krishna say will happen to Arjuna if he renounces, goes to the forest?
He'll go back to his heaven.
He'll go back and just do what he was doing before. So in other words, if someone says, I'm going to renounce everything, great, as long as you can do it. You know what I'm saying? So what's the reason he wants to renounce? Right? Oh, you know, how you say, family life is so cumbersome and so difficult. You know, you always got to do this, that. You can never do what you want. You can always this and that. I just want to get out of it. So does that sound like, yes, this is not here. Now this is sannyas material. Yes? No? No. Why? Because this is renunciation mode of passion. Because it's trouble. That's why you're giving it up. The reason family life is given up is you don't need it anymore. Right? Let us say I have a potato. And I have a potato peeler. Okay? Do I need the potato peeler? Yes. Okay. Now, let's say I have finished peeling the potato. Do I need the potato peeler? Do I maintain attached with it? I walk around the kitchen with a potato peeler. You know? Huh? Yeah, you just it's done. Right? Then after that, then you go to the next stage. You get the knife. And then when you finish with that, you go to the next stage. You know what I'm saying? So it's always going through these stages. So that's the whole point. When that's the reason that one's giving up something because it's not required anymore. Because the purpose that it is supposed to do has been fulfilled. Not that it's too much trouble. Does that make sense? So therefore the sages are saying yes, because he's given it up. And it's not that after a couple of days he's going to, you know, run home. Like that.
We've got to make sure that after we finish peeling the potato, we don't throw the potato peeler in the bin, put it back in the drawer.
The potato peeler?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. But most people throw the potato peeler in the bin and keep the potato peels.
Yeah.
You know? Like that. Potato peels. What's wrong with the potato peels? I like the potato peels. Everybody has potato peels. Like that. You know, you got to move on. You know, just as we said, whether it's Vedic or not Vedic, you still have to move on. But it's easier to move on from the Vedic than it is from the non-Vedic. Because it's designed that way. It's designed to be given up. Well, the modern is designed to keep it eternally. That's the whole idea. Everyone knows it. Sukadeva Goswami begins this chapter by relating that Maharaj Prakrit, back at his royal quarters in Hastinapur, grew more and more distressed as he recalled his behavior towards a faultless Brahmana who he had encountered while touring his kingdom. The mind of the king was upset by such thoughts as, quote, my behavior towards that sage was certainly sinful. The result, no doubt, will be that I shall meet some great difficulty in the near future. My hope is that this calamity, whatever it may be, comes without delay. I wish to immediately atone for my wretchedness. After having paid my just penalty, never again will I commit such an offense. Since I am most uncivilized for having neglected Brahminical culture, let my kingdom, power, and opulence be burnt at once in the fire of the Brahmana's wrath. Only a lesson of this order of severity will teach me to give up my enviousness and inauspicious mentality. So he's looking at it that he didn't need to do that. Right? So he's just looking at that side. So Prabhupada mentioned, the advanced personalities, as soon as something goes wrong, they immediately repent that that shouldn't have been done. They don't try to cover it up and say this and that. You know. So did he get it done? Well, we almost got it done. You know, they don't use stuff like that. Yeah, so this is ridiculous. Why did you guys vote for that? Well, I didn't vote for it. I abstained. You know, they don't use those things. You know, so yes, this is wrong. You know, and then he's willing to do something to correct it. So as soon as the result comes, he immediately takes that and uses it in Krishna consciousness. And it works nicely. Yes.
He can repent himself.
He can repent himself. That's the point. The devotee, because the Brahmins can do that. Right? And so then the devotees being advanced Brahmanas, they can do that. That's why in the Vedic system, then the laws that apply to Brahmanas is what you use when you're dealing with Vaishnavas. These other laws don't apply. So when devotees say, oh, these things don't apply in Kali Yuga, of course they apply in Kali Yuga. The point is if you're a devotee, then the Brahminical ones is what you use. And the other ones you don't. It's simple. To say, oh, but we're not this body. It says these rules are for your body. They're not for you, the soul. They're for your body. The Vedic system, the Varnashram system is for your gross and subtle body. It's not for the soul. No one ever said it's for the soul. It's for your gross and subtle body. Because you're not the body. It's exactly the opposite. That's why the mode of ignorance makes right look like wrong look like right. So but due to the influence of motive ignorance, people say, I'm not this body, I don't have to follow Varnashram, and everyone goes, yes. That's motive ignorance. Motive goodness is, I'm not the body, that's why I should engage the body and mind in Varnashram. But because I'm the soul, that Varnashram must be connected to Krishna. That's Daiva Varnashram. Yes.
Those sampradayas that take Varnashram as a key element, are they taking it as for the soul?
They're taking it for the soul because they're working in majesty. Then the performance of duties in Varnashram is a very major aspect of Vaikuntha Seva. So for them, then, what do you call it? Dasyam. For them, they interpret as Varnashram. While Rupa Goswami makes it clear in Nectar Devotion, we don't interpret it that way. We engage it, but it's not that Dasyam means following Varnashram to please the Lord. Because that's where, what's his name? Ramananda Roy started the discussion. Following Varnashram, please the Lord. He says, no, Lord, what's... Because you know, his point was about the mood, the bhava, the prema. Okay, and now a prema. And it kept going until he got to the gopis, until he got to Radharani. But devotees would take it, see, Lord Chaitanya rejected Varnashram. No, he rejected it as the ultimate goal of life, but not as a process. He follows it himself. How close could the ladies get to Lord Chaitanya and offer obeisances?
Not close at all.
Yeah, Prabhupada says 50 feet. Right? And why was that? Because he's a sannyasin. And then we're going to say Lord Chaitanya rejected Varnashram. As an ultimate goal, yes, but as a process to use in, for the social interaction amongst Vaishnavas, no. Bottom of 58. In his purport to verse 2, Srila Prabhupada writes, the Supreme Lord enjoins that Brahmanas and cows must be given all protection. The Lord is himself very much inclined to do good to Brahmanas and cows. Go Brahmana Hitaya Cha. Maharaj Pricket knew all this, and thus he concluded that his insulting a powerful Brahma was certainly to be punished by the laws of the Lord. And he was expecting something very difficult in the very near future. He therefore desired the imminent calamity to fall on him and not on his family members. A man's personal misconduct affects all his family members. Therefore, Maharaj Pricket desired the calamity to fall on him alone. By suffering personally, he would be restrained from further sins, future sins, and at the same time the sins which he had committed would be counteracted so that his descendants would not suffer. That is the way a responsible devotee thinks. So Prabhupada is saying this is the way you think. It's not that you know, it's just an option. But he just says a responsible devotee. He didn't say someone advanced in devotional service. He just said a responsible devotee. The family members of a devotee also share the effects of a devotee's service unto the Lord. Maharaj Pariksit saved his demon father by his personal devotional service. A devotee's son in the family is the greatest boon or blessing of the Lord. And so you get benefit, but there's also therefore reaction is there. So he just wanted to make sure that nobody else got it, only it was only with him. Yes?
So then reaction goes to the family member, doesn't matter whether he's a devotee or not. It's just...
Yeah. That's just how it works. Because whoever you're related to, it will affect. It may be different how it affects. You know what I'm saying? Just like if something happens to one person, the other person gets affected by that. So it's just, you know, even just from that point of view, something. Let alone that something itself happens to them.
Is that also an ISKCON family?
An ISKCON family. As opposed to... It's a principle. When Prabhupada's talking here, because this is Bhagavatam, it means devotees. Means the point is who are non-devotees? They're devotees who don't know they're devotees. That's all. So it applies to everybody. It's just that when you're dealing on the level of karmakanda, then there's certain aspects that non-devotees will deal with, the devotees won't. You know, as a general rule, unless it's part of the occupational duties. As he was repenting like this, the news of his imminent death due to Sringi's curse reached Maharaj Pariksit. Samika Rishi had sent a messenger to inform the king of the irrevocable curse so that he might properly prepare himself for going back home, back to Godhead. Instead of trying to counteract the curse, Maharaj Pariksit took it as a good opportunity to become indifferent towards all material things. Right, so here we see is that, what's the point? The end game is indifference, not renunciation. We take it, renounce everything. No, it's indifference towards everything. Because if you renounce it, you may still have attachment for it. If you're indifferent towards it, then you don't require it. Indifference means I don't require it. So if it's there or not there, it doesn't matter. That's indifference. Not indifference meaning callous. That's a different word.
How can you renounce and still be attached?
Indifference means whether you do one thing or not.
It's detachment.
But yes, but they work differently. So one is sannyas, means there's no result for you. Renunciation means results mine and I give it away. So there's a difference. Like sannyas wasn't yours in the first place. Yes.
Perhaps you've heard this question before, but in the Mahabharata, I was shocked to read, and a devotee published this edition of the Mahabharata, that there's a different version of this story, where Maharaj Pariksit locks himself into the palace, and Vasuki manages to enter the palace through a Brahmin's offering.
Yes.
Fruit. Yes. So, I've heard some devotees try to explain it away as a culpa thing.
Don't use this word try. Otherwise, then immediately the fragrance that wafts this way is academic. And then the academic basis is simply the false ego of those whose purpose was to destroy the Indian culture. So, if you want to take that route, then you have to take the results of the academy that you would be presenting. The point is every Kali Yuga you have these pastimes. And so therefore, when Swayam Krishna comes, then you have this one where the Bhagavatam is spoken. Because in that other one, was there any Bhagavatam spoken? No. So that's what's unique. When Swayam Krishna comes, then the Bhagavatam is spoken, the Vyasadeva is Vishnu Tattva instead of Jiva Tattva. And so therefore there's a difference there. It's so just the way it works, and if you don't accept that, then why even bother?
Well, okay, so there's some Shastric reference for that.
Yes, it's just how it works. We just went Rupa Goswami and others are all going through how you have the avatars and the different things, what they do in the different kalpas, what things are the same. This Kali Raj is the lord of Kali Yuga. Every time Kali Yuga comes up for 71, for the whole Manvantara. Right? So for 71 Kali Yugas, he runs it. And when it's Dwapara, Dwapara Yuga runs it. That's what the Yuga avatars do. They run it like that. So you're dealing with this again and again, this idea that the material world's fresh. That's mundane. It's the same chewing the chewed. Every Kali Yuga, they do exactly the same thing. It's not that this is new, that we've worked it out, and we're different and unique. Yeah, every time there's a KFC, maybe it's not Kentucky, it's Texas fried chicken, you know, or maybe it's Texas baked chicken, or maybe he doesn't use chicken, he uses pigs, so Texas baked pigs. But whatever it is, it works out the same. So every this point it is, the modes change, and these things come up. And the kalpas, even the kalpa has a particular flavor. And then, you know, it's just like one day has a particular effect. Here the sun's out early, everyone will be more chirpy, it'll kind of affect the whole day. Tomorrow it's cloudy and all that, it'll affect the whole day. That's how a kalpa works. So don't fall into the trap of that's laid for you by the modern academics, that very logical, straightforward answers they reject because they can't perceive it with their imperfect senses. Otherwise, you run the risk of remaining in the material world and not going back to Godhead.
Is it any Vaishnava commentator mentioned the difference between the Mahabharata and the Bhagavatam?
They mention these principles of kalpa and why you get different. Even the Bhagavatam, you have two varahas, white and red. That's two different kalpas. Mm. You know, so when they talk these things, they talk in days of Brahma. So it's called Kalpa Veda. That's the Sanskrit term for it. It's a standard thing. Everybody knows it in the traditional circles. So if you ask Shris, Madhvas, they'll tell you the same thing.
So basically you're saying in every Kali Yuga, Veda Vyas makes an appearance. He compiles the Veda.
Yes, but he's always a Jiva. In this one, he's Vishnu Tattva. And Bhagavatam is revealed. Because Krishna, the avatar is Swayam Krishna, not an expansion of Karanadaksha or Gavadaksha Krishna.
And Purikit gets cursed by Shri.
Yes, yes. You have to remember that the academics limit themselves to studying particular works that they can play around with. They're not really well read. They're scholars. In their own capacity, they scholarly persons, but their view of Vedic culture is not scholarly because they're not well read. And the Sanskrit they know, it's child Sanskrit here in India. Yeah. Children know that Sanskrit.
Yeah, I don't give them any attention. Anymore.
Okay, so therefore that's good. That you'll
yeah,
survive.
I don't care about that.
You'll survive.
Yeah.
So the point is that they come up with these things, but Kalpa Veda is standard. That's just how it works. So that's why Bhagavatam is revealing the element of pure, unalloyed devotional service, while Mahabharata doesn't. Mahabharata is presenting 75,000 verses are not about Krishna and his devotees. 25,000 are. But the point of the work was to give the essence, and the essence is supposed to be to serve Krishna. But Narad Muni points out, because of the 75, you know, in other words, 3-to-1 proportion, people will not catch the one quarter is the important part, just by volume. And in there, he refers to Krishna as the Supreme Lord, but he doesn't bring it out so strongly. So therefore, people will make that mistake. So Mahabharata, if you see it from the angle of the Bhagavatam, then you have no problem. Then all the different things you can use nicely in devotional service. But Mahabharata on its own, without the conclusion of Bhagavatam, then you won't get pure, unaware devotional service. That's why Bhagavatam was then written. And the Bhagavatam we have is 18,000 verses. The original Purana is 1 billion verses. It's So they're much bigger. So this is, that's why Vyasadeva compiles it down into something succinct that we can deal with. Okay. Okay. In his purport to verse 4, Srila Prabhupada writes, Shamika Muni sent news to the king that foolish Sringi, his son, although a powerful Brahmin and boy, unfortunately had misused his spiritual power by cursing the king unwarrantedly. Right? That's why it was called immature, because he misapplied it. It doesn't mean that the Brahminical thing is wrong, it doesn't matter how he deals, it's that he misapplied it. Right? The incident of the king's garlanding the Muni was not sufficient cause for being cursed to death, right? Because Manu gives how things work, and they're always balanced. They're always balanced. So it has to be in connection with what is actually done. You can't take it beyond. Right? Like that. You know, you don't get out a howitzer for a mosquito. You know, it's not necessary. The incident of the king's garlanding Muni was not sufficient cause for being cursed to death, but since there was no way to retract the curse, the king was informed to prepare for death within a week. Both Shamika Muni and the king were self-realized souls. Shamika Muni was a mystic, and Maharaj Parikit was a devotee. Therefore, there was no difference between them and self-realization. Right? So self-realization means they're both on the transcendental platform. That it's the same. Now, what their position beyond self, within self-realization, that's where the difference comes. So in other words, Samika, he's on the platform, he understands Brahman. It doesn't mention whether he understands beyond that. But he was situated there. But Sukadeva is a devotee, therefore then he's dealing with Bhagavan. So self-realization means you're focused on Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. Like that. So on that platform, they're the same. Now, connected with the material world, they're exactly the same. Yeah, so basically you say one's Hamsa, one's Paramahamsa.
Oh, yeah. On that level, that high.
Yeah, because he says there's self-realized, there's no difference. So he's able to, you know, go when he wants into trance, into samadhi, and come out of it when he wants.
Yes.
You know, so we see the yogis, they're doing it, you know, it takes 10,000 years, 60,000 years to do this. So he can do it as he needs.
And also the fact that he's actually concerned that the king should know about the curse.
Yes, that, but also, yeah, just so that he can use it for self-realization. And here, that he's come to the conclusion that he won't counteract the curse. Because he knows the king, is, as a Mahabhagavad, is more powerful than his son as a Brahmin. But he knows that because of that, he won't counteract the curse. Right? So even it's just here, as Prabhu was mentioning, the Mahabharata, that even the mood of Parikit was still very glorious in that, because the sun was going down on the last day, and he's thinking that the Brahmin has made this curse. So for the, the maintenance of the position of the pure word of the Brahmin that he has spoken, it should come true. He said that because he saw this bug on the fruit. He says, I'll take this bug and we'll name him Takshaka. And then putting him on my neck, then, you know, bugs bite. Mm-hmm. And so then it will be true. What he said was true. I was bitten by Takshaka on the seventh day. Just to maintain that. Otherwise, he could have said, no, it's nonsense. But he didn't. He was even there trying to because of his culture. Like that. Unfortunately, it was toxic. You know, so it didn't work out so good in the end. But, you know, that's the thing. So there he acted just as a Kshatriya. In this age, he acts as a Mahabhagavata. So it just depends on the situation. Like you see, is the Yudhishthira and his brothers at the end acted just like great devotees, but during the lifetime, then they acted as Kshatriyas. So Prabhupada mentioned because they're devotees, and they it's like two rails on a train. You follow the devotional, the Bhagavat, but at the same time you follow what is your occupational duty. And you do them both at once. But then there comes a point in the life where you can drop the one and just do the other. It works. Neither of them was afraid of meeting death. Mars Prickett could have gone to the Muni to beg his pardon, but the news of imminent death was conveyed to the king with so much regret by the Muni that the king did not want to shame the Muni further by his presence there, right? Because the Muni was feeling so bad. So otherwise he would have gone and said something, but because he'll feel worse, he didn't go. Because it's not about myself. You know, I have to say something. You know, you have to, means that's very self-centered. One has to see also, okay, you have to say, but you're saying to somebody, so there must be an interaction there. He decided to prepare himself for his imminent death and find out the way to go back to Godhead. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur writes, he heard how he would die from Takshika in 7 days as pronounced by the son of the sage from a student called Gauramukha, sent by Shamika. O king, hearing about the curse made by his ignorant son, regretting it repeatedly, our guru scolded his son and, not seeing any remedy, fell into grief. Full of suffering, he sent me to you with a message. Understanding this, the king should make preparations for departing. End quote. When the messenger had departed, the king wanted to go there to beg forgiveness for his offense. But considering that the sage would be embarrassed, and also because he did not desire negation of the curse, he did not go. Because he could have negated the curse and then gone there. But he would have felt embarrassed because he already thought it's very minor. So he's looking at it, my son, I'm responsible for my son because he's not mature yet. And he is cursed, so then therefore the responsibility lies with me to deal with this. So now the king thought Shamika will feel bad because it's not balanced, the two. The one doesn't match with the other. Like that. It's only feelings, because feelings are one thing. Because feelings, you can build them up to huge, and they don't match the situation. It's very common. We build everything up, and then it's not something great. It's just like Baba gives the example of, I think it was something, the Himalayas were going to give birth to something like this. So everybody was, all the demigods, everybody was around, and they were thinking, wow, what's going to happen? And then at the moment when it came, just rats came out. You know, it's kind of like, huh? You know, so this whole thing is things being built up. So that's what we do. So we will think it's just because of our feelings. But that's what the Vedas teach about, is self-realization means you as the soul, not you as the mind, because we're not the mind. That's what self-realization is. Then you have to know what the mind is. In other words, if one has a particular kind of mind, it will react in these kind of ways. It happens. So therefore, when flares up, great, it'll go down. Some flare up, it doesn't go down. So be more careful. You know, not that because it flares up, then that's me and I have to do what I need. And what about me? You know, we have to be very, very careful about this. Right? Self-realization means it's about us, but we have to know who's us. He considered the fiery poison of Takshika beneficial because it would produce detachment from all his attachments. Okay, so that'll be the benefit. He'll give up all attachments to the world because it's just the way it works. Sutta Goswami continued, Maharaj Prickett's mind resolved to meet the death fate had it ordained for him. The king first of all handed over his kingdom to his son. He then sat down firmly on the banks of the river dearest to the Lord, whose current carries the dust and tulsi leaves of his lotus feet. So he's firmly fixed. In other words, he's starting this process from nishta. Right? He's just going, sitting there. He's not going to run around. He's not going to do all that. He's just sitting down there. Because if you want to attain the Lord, what a better place than the Ganga, which is carrying the flavor of the tulsi from the lotus feet of the Lord. So you've already technically attained the lotus feet of the Lord. The king's determination was to give up his life by fasting with his mind firmly concentrated upon the lotus feet of the Lord. Srila Prabhupada draws their attention to the fact that while the conversation is that King Parikit took shelter of the Ganges, in fact the river Jamuna flows through Hastinapur, Delhi. Well, the Ganges proper does not. The Yamuna is, as Srila Prabhupada points out, in the purport of verse 6, more associated with Sri Krishna than even the Ganga. Her waters are dear to Krishna for carrying the holy dust of the Lord's lotus feet mixed with tulsi leaves. The Yamuna, being a tributary of the Ganges, may be referred to by that name also. At Prayag, Allahabad, southwest of Delhi, the two rivers meet to become one. In the same purport, Srila Prabhupada makes clear that the version of no less than Srila Jiva Goswami is that Maharaj Parikit actually took shelter of the river Jamuna. The Goswami cites the Varaha Purana statement that while there is no difference between the two, still, when the waters of the Ganges are sanctified 100 times, it is called the Jamuna. This is compared to the spiritual statement that 1,000 names of Vishnu equal one name of Rama, and 3 names of Rama are equal to one name of Krishna. News of the emperor's spread. So it's the same, because the water comes down, but it splits into all these different aspects, as it has, because there's 4 different aspects, actually, of the Ganga. So there's the main Ganga, but at the same time, it has these 3 other aspects. So the Alakananda, because I think he only stays in the Himalayas. She doesn't leave Himalayas, so she just goes down to that point. So they come in. So then Ganga goes and Jamuna goes separately, then they meet in Prayag. Right there.
Is Bhagirathi?
Bhagirathi, Alakananda. These enter earlier.
Maharaj?
Yes.
I have a question than the previous point. So when Maharaj Parikshit took the decision to accept the curse, he did not confirm with anyone.
He's a devotee. He knows what should be done there. Because the point is this, consulting with the Brahmins and that would be in the position of a king. So now he's going to do that in ashram, in a sense. In other words, when we talk about kings consulting the Brahmins, we're talking about in Varna.
Yes.
But in ashram, they'll cultivate from the sages.
Yes.
Does that make sense? So now he's leaving and then going down to the bank of the river and then consulting the sages.
Yes.
So it's the same thing. It's just because when you give up the trappings, then all there is ashram dharma, though you may not connect with one particular ashram. Because the ashram dharma is one, it's how you say, it's one ashram. It's one ashram, just you have 4 aspects to it to make sure that these elements are learned, and make sure it's clear so there's a prominence. In other words, that with that full surrender to the Lord, working on authority and everything, you're going to engage the senses in the Lord's service without, and the result that comes will be given to the Lord without a desire that the Lord is, the results are yours.
Yes.
You got that?
Yes.
We got all 4 ashrams there.
Yes.
Yeah? You understand? So that's what we're trying to do. But, so therefore there's a practice to go through those 4. But the point of sannyas, meaning there's indifference to the material and every action you do is for the Lord's pleasure. That can be practiced by the brahmacharya. You don't have to wait till sannyas for that. That whatever you get, the results of it are not for you, but they're given to Krishna. So that position of vanaprastha, you don't have to wait for that. You can do that now. That you engage your senses in the Lord's service. You don't have to wait for grihastha life. You can do that now.
Yes.
Does that make sense? So the point is all those are there, but this is where you situate yourself according to what is the position. Right? I mean, Sukadeva Goswami already understood all these 4, so therefore he didn't bother with brahmachari life. He just went immediately to Paramahamsa. So as soon as he's born, he just runs off into the forest. Does that make sense? You know, you know, Narad Muni goes to Brahmacharya Paramahamsa. Like that. So you see different personalities will use the system. But the idea is that you want all these 4 aspects. So devotional service already accommodates that. So, okay. News of the emperor's great renunciation spread quickly throughout the universe. On the plea of making a pilgrim's journey, all of the great rishis came there along with their disciples, knowing that Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken by Sukadeva Goswami. Footnote 19. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains, the sages came to see Parikit not to bathe, since they were already pure. Quote, but they are seen to visit holy places. End quote. This is only a pretext, prayena. They had understood that seeing Parikit was superior to seeing the holy places. Understanding suddenly by their omniscience that they could not taste astonishing bliss in any other way, they came to drink the sweetness of the Bhagavatam. So these are great personalities who they can see what's going on. They have that vision, that perfect vision. So they can see now that within transcendence, this is going to be the greatest. So then they're coming from all over. Right? The pretext is they're coming to holy places because they'll come there, they'll live there, they'll do the duties that you do in that place. But their real purpose of coming there was to hear Bhagavatam. And so Maharaj Parikit was soon surrounded by such spiritual authorities, Narad Muni, Srila Vyasadeva, Bhrigu, Vasishtha, Parasara, Atri, Vishwamitra, Angira, Parashuram, Bharadvaj, Gautama, Chyavana, Sharadvan, Utatya, Maitreya, and Aurva. Verses 7 to 10. In his purports to verses 9 to 10, Srila Prabhupada outlines the life stories of many of the sages named in these verses. Okay. Bhrigu, when Brahmaji was performing a great sacrifice on behalf of Varuna, Maharshi Bhrigu was born from the sacrificial fire. He was a great sage, and his very dear wife was Puloma. He could travel in space like Durvasa. Remember, Puloma was the one where, and then there was a Rakshasa named Paloma. That's a whole nother. That's how Chyavana was born. Because Chyavana was Bhrigu's son. Because Paloma, he was a Rakshasa who Paloma, the girl, had been betrothed to before. But then the father came along this opportunity to that she be married to Bhrigu. Right? So that who's originally a son of Brahma, but he's appeared from the fire at Varuna because of a curse. I think it was you mentioned before about this one curses that one curses, they both end up with no body, so he's the man.
Oh, okay.
Right? So he appeared, that, therefore he's known after this as Varuna's son, though ultimately he's a Brahmarshi. Right? So then the Rakshasa came and then figured out that this is the girl. But to confirm it, then he went to the fire, because he knows he has to speak truth, and says, is this that girl? And so Agni doesn't want to say, because if he says, he'll kidnap the girl. But at the same time, he doesn't want to not tell the truth, because that would be improper. So then he tries to say in a way that he is, he means this girl, the wife of Bhrigu, right? He already starts from there, it's already there. Was the original girl that was betrothed to you. He doesn't just say, you know, he starts from that. And so the Rakshasa steals the girl. So he's running off in the form of a boar. And then because of that, then Chavan in the womb becomes really angered and he drops out of the womb. And just with his effulgence, he's so powerful, he just burns the demon to ashes. Like that. So because of that, because of his effulgence, he's known as Chavana. Right? So that's why then. And he created the recipe, the Chavan Prash. So that's why he I'm very effulgent. Tejas. Maybe not that much Tejas, but okay. Right? Yeah. Means in other words, if you go to a pig farm and there's a problem, then, you know, don't. He could travel in space like Durvasa, Narad, and others, and he used to visit all the planets of the universe. Before the battle of Kurukshetra, he tried to stop the battle. Sometimes he instructed Bharadvaj Muni about astronomical evolution, and he is the author of the great Bhrigu Samhita. Right, so Bharadvaj is also astronomy, because he's the original author of all these things. He's the one who knows the most. Then others taking from him and give different aspects.
Bharadvaj or Bhrigu?
Bhrigu. Because Bhrigu Samhita is the oldest. It's a huge work. Nowadays, there's bits and pieces of it left. So there's like 30 people that have that are Bhrigu astrologers. Each one has some aspect of it. But they'll never combine it, because then they'll think they'll lose their uniqueness. Right? Well, they could combine it, and then you'd have maybe possibly a complete Shastra, but they're not about to do that. So what to do?
Also the Bhrigu Sutra.
The Bhrigu Sutra. He explained how the air in the stomach works and regulates the intestines. As a great philosopher, he logically established the eternity of the living entity in Mahabharata. He was also a great anthropologist, and the theory of evolution was long ago explained by him. He was a scientific propounder of the four divisions and orders of human society, known as the Varnashram institution. He converted the Kshatriya king Vitahavya into a Brahmana. And I know Vitahavya is Vishwamitra. Vishishta, yes.
What is his connection to Mahabharata? It's mentioned here that...
It just means that this topic, as a great philosophy, logically established eternity of the living entity in Mahabharata. So the conversation there is where we have it. Vashishta, the great celebrated sage amongst the Brahmanas, well known as the Vashishta Deva. He is a prominent figure in both the Ramayana and Mahabharata periods. He celebrated the coronation ceremony of the personality of Godhead, Sri Rama, because he was the Rajguru at that time. He was present also on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. He could approach all the higher and lower planets. And his name is also connected with the history of Hiranyakashipu. There was a great tension between him and Vishwamitra, who wanted his Kamadhenu, wish-fulfilling cow. Vashishtha Muni refused to spare his Kamadhenu, and for this, Vishwamitra killed his 100 sons. As a perfect Brahmana, he tolerated all the taunts of Vishwamitra. Once he tried to commit suicide on account of Vishwamitra's torture, but all his attempts were unsuccessful. Right. Oh, he jumped from a hill, but the stones on which he fell became a stack of cotton, and thus he was saved. He jumped into the ocean, but the waves washed him ashore. He jumped into the river, but the river also washed him ashore. Thus all his suicide attempts were unsuccessful. He is also one of the seven rishis and husband of Arundhati, the famous star. Right, so in weddings, then, it's always mentioned about this relationship of Arundhati and Vashishtha. Right, they're part of the seven sages, the Big Dipper. So, because that's the one that's there. You can see it's going around Dhruva. It's obvious you can see it's going around Dhruva Loka. The other ones, it's sometimes harder to appreciate.
The torturous relationship, that was when...
Torturous relationship. Because he's always creating this competition, because Vishwamitra was a king, that I know he's what was his name? Vitahavya. Like that. And so, that underlying element, there is that competitive aspect. That's why it's not recommended to have these mixes. Because of that. Not that he doesn't function as a great Brahmin and can do all these things. Not that he's not qualified. It's just that there'll be that little bit of flavor there. Parasara. He is the grandson of Vashishtha Muni and father of Vyasadeva. He is the son of Maharshi Shakti, and his mother's name was Adrishyati. He was in the womb of his mother when she was only 12 years old, and from within the womb of his mother he learned the Vedas. His father was killed by a Dima called Mashapada, and to avenge this, he wanted to annihilate the whole world. Oh, okay. So that's why that Kalmashapada story comes. So wait a minute, why would that story? Because Kalmashapada he's the one that killed Parasara's father, who was the son of Bhrigu. Right? And then you get Parasaram. So it's part of the story of Parasara. You know, then from Parasara, then you get Vyasadeva, like this, and then you get the members of the the Kuru dynasty, and then you get the Mahabharata war. So it all goes in a line. He was restrained, however, by his grandfather, Vishishta. He then performed a Rakshasa-killing yajna, but Maharshi Pulastya restrained him, because the Rakshasas are all born from Pulastya. He begot Vyasadeva, being attracted by Satyavati, who was to become the wife of Maharaj Shantanu. By the blessings of Parasara, Satyavati became fragrant for miles. He was present also during the time of Bhishma's death. He was spiritual master of Maharaj Janaka and a great devotee of Lord Shiva. He is the author of many Vedic scriptures and sociological directions. Because right? he wrote a Dharma Shastra expanding the details of Manu in application of Kali Yuga. Right? So how one can better understand its use in Kali Yuga. Not that it's a separate thing. It's how to apply Manu in Kali Yuga. Gaudi Sutta, or Vishwamitra. A great sage of austerity and mystic power, he is famous as Gaudi Sutta because his father was Gaudi, a powerful king of the province of Kanyakubja, part of Uttar Pradesh. Although he's a Kshatriya by birth, he became a Brahmana in the very same body by the power of his spiritual achievements. He picked a quarrel with Vishishta Muni when he was a Kshatriya king, and performed a great sacrifice in cooperation with Matanga Muni, and thus was able to vanquish the sons of Vishishta. He became a great yogi, and yet he failed to check his senses, and thus was obliged to become the father of Shakuntala, the beautiful queen of world history. Yes, she's Bharat Maharaj's mother. Once when he was a Kshatriya king, he visited the hermitage of Vishishta Muni, and he was given a royal reception. Vishwamitra wanted from Vishishta a cow named Nandini, and the Muni refused to deliver it. Vishwamitra stole the cow, and thus there was a quarrel between the sage and the king. Vishwamitra was defeated by the spiritual strength of Vishishta, and thus the king decided to become a Brahmana. Before becoming a Brahmana, he underwent severe austerity on the bank of the Kaushika. He was also one who tried to stop the Kurukshetra war. Right, in other words, it's the Lord's desire it'll happen, but it's not the sage's duties not to advise what should be wrong. Because there must be proper instruction, but it's understood by the modes of nature they're still going to do whatever they're going to do. Angira. He is one of the six mental sons of Brahma and the father of Brihaspati, the great learned priest of the demigods in the heavenly planets. He was born of the semen of Brahmaji, given to a cinder of fire. Utya and Samvarta are his sons. It is said that he is still performing austerity and chanting the holy name of the Lord at a place known as Alokananda on the bank of the Ganges. Parasurama, or Renuka Sutta. He is the son of Maharshi Jamadagni and Srimati Renuka. Thus, he is also known as Renuka Sutta. He is one of the powerful incarnations of God, and he killed the Kshatriya community as a whole 21 times. With the blood of the Kshatriyas, he pleased the souls of his forefathers. Later on, he underwent severe penances on the Mahendra Parvata. After taking the whole earth from the Kshatriyas, he gave it in charity to Kasapa Muni. Parasaram instructed the Dhanur Veda, or the science of fighting, to Dronacharya because he happened to be a Brahmana. He was present during the coronation of Maharaj Yudhishthira, and he celebrated the function along with other great rishis. Right, so we see here again that element, because there was that cross-up, that the two pots of sweet rice were there from Putra Kameshti Yajna, the desire to have sons, that one pot was for the king, for his queen, and one pot was for Jamadagni, for his wife, right? But somehow or another, the pots became mixed up. So Jamadagni's wife, his Brahman, drank the pot meant for the Kshatriya, and the other way around. So therefore, he ended up with Parasaram as his son. So he's Brahminical, but he has that Kshatriya spirit of sense of justice and these kind of things. Uttaya, one of the three sons of Maharshi Angira. He was the spiritual master of Maharaj Mandata. Right, so Mandata, what did Mandata was doing something. Wasn't he doing
something?
Didn't they mention Mandata before just as somebody involved? Yes, I'm mixing it up with Matanga. He married Bhadra, daughter of Soma, the moon. Varuna kidnapped his wife, Bhadra, and to retaliate the offense of the god of water, he drank all the water of the world. Okay. Here's another one. Because he controls the water, so he suck up all the water and then nothing to control. Medatiti, an old sage of yore, an assembly member of the heavenly king Indradeva. His son was Kandva Muni, who brought up Shakuntala in the forest. He was promoted to the heavenly planet by strictly following the principles of retired life, Vanaprastha. So he would be one who would that's where they situate themselves and they perform their austerities in that, from that position. So you attain perfection from that. Does that make sense? Devala, a great authority like Narad Muni and Vyasadeva. His good name is on the list of authorities mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita when Arjuna acknowledged Lord Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He met Maharaj Yudhishthira after the Battle of Kurukshetra, and he was the elder brother of Domya, the priest of the Pandava family. Like the Kshatriyas, he also allowed his daughter to select her own husband in a Swayambar meeting, and at that ceremony all the bachelor sons of the rishis were invited. According to some, he is not a Sita Devala. So some say Devala means, and Asita Devala are the same, some say they're different. Bharadvaj, he is one of the seven great rishis and was present at the time of the birth ceremony of Arjuna. The powerful rishi sometimes undertook severe penances on the shore of the Ganges, and his ashram is still celebrated at Prayagatama. It is learned that the rishi, while taking bath in the Ganges, happened to meet Gritachi, one of the beautiful society girls of heaven. I think she's one of the five. Right. And thus he discharged semen, which was kept and preserved in an earthen pot and from which Drona was born. So Dronacharya is the son of Bharadwaj, Muni. Others say that Bharadwaj, the father of Drona, is a different person from Maharshi Bharadwaj. He was a great devotee of Brahma. Once he approached Dronacharya and requested him to stop the battle of Kurukshetra. So we'll stop him.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki Jai Samaveta Bhaktavrinda ki Jai Nitya Gaur ki.